It is an immutable fact that the Bible has been, is, always will be the best-selling book of all time. There is just no getting around it. Although if you look at a bestseller list or the top-selling, best-selling books of all time, you probably won't see the Bible on there because it's so much the best-selling book of all time, they don't even include it on the lists, it seems. But just to give you an idea of just how much that is the case, the top five, starting at number five, the first of the Harry Potter books, 120 million copies. I just lost my list here. But the next one was 200 million or so, and then or another 100-something million, then 200 million. The top best-selling book on the actual list is 500 million. Then there's the Bible that is estimated at this point at over 5 billion. So not even close. That's why they don't even put it on the list. Of course, there may be other reasons they don't put it on the list, but that would be a good enough reason because nobody's ever going to catch that. It's an amazing book for so many reasons, but even from a practical standpoint, just how much good content it has to help us in our lives, help people in life. Self-help books are very popular books. I don't know if they're very helpful, but I know they're very popular. And I know they're popular because of how much they're made. They wouldn't be published if people didn't buy them. So whether or not they get any help out of them, people buy them like crazy, and which apparently shows that they want help in how to better their lives. They want to know what can I do to make my life better, to have more success, maybe to be more successful in business, or I want to get better at a certain thing that I've always wanted to do, or that I know I have a lot of improvement to do. Maybe it's an emotional thing or a mental thing. Whatever it is, people buy self-help books, and they buy them a lot. People want to know how to succeed in life. How can I get to this point in my life where I will be able to be satisfied or successful, at least satisfied with my level of success? The Bible, believe it or not, is not actually a self-help book per se, but it does help. It does tell us how we can succeed. How can I succeed in life? What can I do to succeed? The Word of God tells us. And what we're going to do this morning is we're going to try to look into that by looking at the life of one of the most talked about and quoted memorable characters in the Bible. His name is David. Maybe you've heard of him. King David. Probably heard a lot about him. But we have to ask the question, what is success? If you're going to talk about success, you have to know what it is. A lot of people would define success differently in a lot of different ways. Money. It has to do with money, some might say, or fame, or popularity, or whatever it may be. The Hebrew word that's translated success is a word, sakal. It's used about 70 times in the Old Testament, and it means to be prudent, to be circumspect, wisely understand, prosper, to act circumspectly, to act prudently, to act wisely, to be wise, or to prosper. It sounds strange, doesn't it? We're talking about the word success, and yet all these definitions seem to say that it means prudent and circumspect and to be wise and to have understanding. Joshua chapter 1 verse 8 is a place where this word is used when God told Joshua, "You will have good success if you keep to my word, if you keep to my commandments, if you don't swerve to the right or to the left, then you will have good success." That's that word, sakal. But it's also used in Psalm 32, verse 8. "I will instruct you and teach you." That's the same word. Proverbs 16, 20. "He who heeds the word wisely." That's that same Hebrew word again. So putting it all together, that word, that Hebrew word, it connotes the idea of prospering via wisdom and understanding, or because of wisdom and understanding. And we see that spelled out if you compare passages, if you compare translations of these passages here, taken from 1 Samuel 18. Here's our key phrases, our key phrase from these passages in 1 Samuel 18, four different times. we read, depending on your translation, that David behaved himself wisely. So we're looking at keys to success in the life of David. We can also find some keys to failure in the life of David. But we're going to look at the part of David's life that give us some keys to success. And I believe this is it right here. That David behaved himself wisely in all his ways. Wherever he went, whatever he was doing, he behaved himself wisely. If you compare that with this is from the ASV, the Old American Standard Version, and probably some others as well. The ESV, however, translates that word, was successful, all four times. David went out and was successful wherever he went, wherever Saul sent him. David had success in all his undertakings. David, when Saul saw that David had great success, he stood in awe of him, and David had more success than all the servants of Saul. So, okay, what is it? What gives? Does that word mean to behave wisely or to have success? The answer is yes. It means both of those things. They are inseparably connected. Wise behavior and great success are inseparable as far as the Bible is concerned. Wise behavior. This morning what we're going to do, we're going to see, and Lord willing next week we'll look at a couple of other things, three things total. Today, David behaved wisely by redeeming developing relationships. We got two do's and a don't. Just the first one today. The first do. Develop redeeming relationships. That's our mustard seed, if you will, for this morning. Redeeming, developing relationships. That was maybe the first, one of the first wise things that led to David's success was that right there. And he did it in a number of areas of life. It's not always easy to develop relationships at all. For some, more than others. Some of you are much more skilled at that than, say, somebody like me. But to develop redeeming relationships is even more difficult at times. But David did this, and his life was different because of that. His life was elevated and had more success than he would have had otherwise. First of all, David found, he developed redeeming relationships because he found acceptance with those in high positions. Those who are in high positions. He developed, found acceptance with the high. He went out wherever Saul sent him. Saul was pretty high. He was the highest of the high, as far as man was concerned. Among men, the king was number one. Wherever Saul sent him, David went there. You might call that willful submission to authority. That was wise behavior. Willfully submitting to authority. What if David didn't want to go there, wherever he sent him? Didn't matter. That was totally irrelevant. His authority figure, his superior, told him to do it, and he did it. And so he was accepted by those in high places. A lot of times, it's power that gets you acceptance with the high people in high places. In fact, it was the case with David as well. What we didn't read, the section that Jake started reading just a second ago, was right after he had killed Goliath. That's what his number one feat was that he killed Goliath, the big giant that everybody was scared of. He took him on, and he was famous instantly. His fame spread everywhere. So that act alone instantly placed him in high favor with the people in power because he did them a great favor. But David didn't just have acceptance with those who were in high places. But he also was popular with the people in low places. Now that's not easy to do at all. To be popular with the people in high places and to be popular with people in low places. Because it takes two totally different traits. Killing Goliath made him famous, but it didn't necessarily make him popular so to speak. It all that would depend on what kind of man David was. Certain kind of men could have killed Goliath and everybody would know his name, but they would hate his guts too, because who could like a man like that? You think about some characters we read about in the Bible, that like Haman in the book of Esther. How could anybody like him? You know, he was such a slippery scoundrel and troublemaker and puffed up, and I'm going to kill you if you don't bow down to me and all this stuff. Who could like him? Now, he had popularity and acceptance with the people in high places, but not the lowly. David had both. And the reason is because of his humility. He was the most famous man in the whole country. Now, he was so famous that women were singing about him in the streets. That's famous. I don't know anybody that's true of. Singing songs about him, writing songs. They're out there with their tambourines and their timbrels or whatever they got, and they're singing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. That was the most popular song on the charts back then. David was that famous. Everybody knew his name, but everybody loved him because he served with the same humility that he had before any of that ever happened. That was what was unique about David and his wise behavior, was he was humble. He still viewed himself as that shepherd boy from Bethlehem that he always was. That's who he kept being. He didn't let that stuff get to his head. He was now he's in the royal court. The king wants, I'm his, you know, his number one guy. If he needs something done, he sends me. David could have been the most stuck up and smug man in the whole country because of this quick rise to fame and the fact that he was the one that killed the giant. And he could have been like, I don't have to do what you people want me to do. Do you know who I am? I killed a giant with a slingshot. I think I can take care of you if I needed to. So get out of here. Or you think I want to talk to you people? I've got bigger things to do. I've got a dinner party to go to, or I've got to go see to the king's royal decrees and things like that. But David was a humble man, even though he was the most famous man in the world. Celebrities are in the country. Celebrities, that's a rare quality. 1 in 100, maybe, are humble in spite of their fame. And especially humble in a way that actually moves people to be impressed by their humility and genuine kindness and things like that. I've heard stories about Tom Cruise that are like that. I'm always moved by that. Tom Cruise, the most famous actor probably of our time, and rightly so, and yet some of the stories that different actors and crew members tell about him, but that's a rare quality. Most people won't even know their names. Don't know your name, don't care about your name. Go get me my soy milk latte and don't look at me. Not David. David was accepted by the high people, but also the lowly. He was popular, and everybody loved him. Every single person liked him, loved him. In fact, the whole country was a fan of his because he behaved wisely in that way, among others. He behaved wisely. But finally, the thing we're going to focus on is that in his developing redeeming relationships is that he found friendship with the godly. He found acceptance with the high, he found popularity with the low, but he found friendship with the godly, namely Jonathan. Jonathan. Now I submit to you that David's friendship with Jonathan, second only to his faithfulness to God, his friendship with Jonathan is the single thing that made his life what it was. His friendship with Jonathan. And I'm confident in saying that because he wouldn't have had much of a life if it wasn't for that. He would have been dead. Now, God protected him a lot too. Several times he would have been killed if God hadn't stepped in. But there was at least one time when he would have been killed if it hadn't been for Jonathan, which was probably God's work in some way also. Well, who cares about David's friendship with Jonathan? Who is Jonathan? I don't know who he is, and why does that mean anything to me? Well, Jonathan was the son of Saul. He was Saul's son. He was presumably, he was the heir to the throne. He was the prince of Israel. He was a courageous warrior. He was a man of God. He was a beloved leader. The people loved Jonathan. Jonathan, they loved. They probably didn't love his dad too much, but they loved him. We talked several weeks ago, about Jonathan and his armor bearer going up to this Philistine garrison and how just the two of them, and he said, look, if Jehovah's with us, then we'll win. They don't have a chance. If there's a chance that God will fight for us, so we need to do this. That's the kind of man Jonathan was. He had faith in God, but he was a man that inspired loyalty and love, and the people just probably could not wait for Saul to die so Jonathan could be king. Jonathan would have been a great king. But what we're seeing about Jonathan here was his friendship to David, which seems like something that would never happen. As much as Saul came to resent David, Jonathan naturally would have hated him just as much, if not more, because for the same reasons, a threat. He's a threat. I don't want this guy at court. But what we read in the beginning of chapter 18 of 1 Samuel is that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And he loved him. Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Against all odds, David's killed this giant. The king, Saul, brings him into the royal court. All this ceremony probably and making a big deal out of it. And David now is not going to be allowed to leave. He's here for good. You don't go back to Bethlehem. You're done with small-time Bethlehem stuff. You're done with sheep. You're staying here. Jonathan probably would have hated him more than anybody in the world. But he didn't. He not only did not hate him, but it says he loved him as his own soul. That says something about David and Jonathan, in fact. I don't know who it says more about, maybe equal, that David was a man that Jonathan felt that way about. His soul was knit to him. That word bound or tied. The NIV says they were one in spirit. But it's stronger than that, I think. They became the best of friends. And David's life would be changed forever because of that. For the good. His friendship with this godly man. David was going to have some tough times in the near future. Because after all this celebration and stuff wears off, Saul starts to get jealous of David and he tries to kill him over and over. And that really weighed on David's heart, his spiritual well-being, his emotional well-being. He wouldn't allow himself to stoop and kill Saul despite being encouraged to do so. He said, "Nope, this is the Lord's chosen and I'm not going to touch him. I'll be the king as soon as God wants me to be." But if it wasn't for Jonathan, he wouldn't have made it. He never would have made it through. Jonathan was such a man that was so unique compared to most princes historically that the people saved his life when the king was going to kill him. He was going to execute him for eating some honey. And they stood up and said, "No, you're not." That takes courage. And again, that says something about Jonathan. This kind of man he was. And he was a man that David needed in his life. He didn't know it. But apparently God did. God knew that. And here he is. Instead of hating him, his soul was knit, bound to him. He takes off his robe and his bow and his girdle, his belt, and he presents his sword. He presents it to David. And many commentators, scholars believe that was a sign of Jonathan saying, I know that I will never sit on my father's throne, but that you will. God had already told him that. Long ago, he told Samuel, and Samuel went to Jesse's house and got him. But Jonathan, apparently knew. And yet he still didn't envy him. But he was devoted to him like a true brother, a true friend. So David's friendship, he developed these redeeming relationships with the people in high places. Now, he didn't sin in order to do that. Many times, that's what you would have to do. You'd have to be shady or corrupt to be accepted by people in high places. It's not always the case, though. David didn't do anything like that, but it was his valor and feats of strength that got him that, not to mention his personality and general demeanor. He had a popularity with the people that were lowly, and he found friendship with the godly. Jonathan saved his life literally and spiritually. Jonathan was there. And many times in this chapter, we see Jonathan and David coming together, and David is just falling apart. And Jonathan is the one that's there to hold him together and to help him out in whatever way, behind his father's back, mind you. He was helping him. What would David have been without Jonathan? Without redeeming or developing those redeeming relationships, especially with Jonathan. He didn't have many friends, but the ones that he did have counted because they were godly, good, godly, God-fearing, God-serving people. What lessons can we learn from this chapter? We didn't really look a whole lot at the actual text of the chapter. It's mainly the first section here, but that wise behavior, what can we learn from the life of David? Well, first of all, by application for us, it's impossible to live the Christian life alone. Wayne just made that point in our Bible study a minute ago, and it is a very powerful and very true point. You can't live a godly life alone. It's impossible. It is literally impossible. God didn't intend for it to be that way. He didn't intend for it to be a Lone Ranger type religion and system, but it's a one another faith. Christianity is a one another religion. And we as Christians need to be knit to each other. We read about that in Ephesians chapter 4. Knit together, joined together, like the body. As much as your hand is a part of your arm and as much as that is a part of your core and your body, we ought to be that way as Christians in the body of Christ. But we shouldn't look for that kind of relationship with people in the world. If our souls are knit to people in the world, we're going to be influenced by them to be pulled away from God. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't develop relationships with people in the world. That's crucial to being able to evangelize. But we shouldn't have this same bond with them as we do with our brothers and sisters and those who are in Christ. It's similar to our the difference in our relationship we have with our spouses compared to, you know, other people. It's not that they're the only person that we can have a relationship with at all, but you better believe it's different. It better be different than the relationship we have with other people. We need to look for these relationships like David and Jonathan had among those in the church. Number two, God brings people into our lives or can bring people into our lives that we will need in the future. If it wasn't for Jonathan, David would have been killed, never become king. David had to lean on Jonathan often. We don't know what God has in store for the rest of our lives. We have no way of knowing that. We also have no way of knowing who might show up that God is able and willing and will use in our lives. David didn't know anything about God, as far as we know, that Jonathan was there by God's providence. But I don't see any way to get around that from our perspective looking back on these events and the events of David's early life, I don't see any conclusion but that God put Jonathan in David's life. Jonathan, God was working with him providentially in different ways that we can't possibly understand. That he was just the right kind of man that would be drawn to David instead of drawn to hate him, and that he would be there for him and be devoted to him. It was a lot about the kind of man Jonathan was, but God had something to do with that. So just like David didn't know, we don't know either. God could bring somebody into our lives that is going to be used by God to help us, to build us up, or vice versa. We could be somebody God could use, that could providentially bring about somebody's spiritual growth and uplifting. We don't know. But if we choose to be that person, we can be. God can use people. He knows that we all need a Jonathan in our lives, and he can help us to find one. Proverbs 18, verse 24 says, says, "There are friends who may be a man's destruction." Isn't that the truth? Some friends, worst decision you ever made is become friends with them. In retrospect, of course, hindsight. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Equally true. The people we choose as our friends is important. It makes a difference in life. Bad companions corrupt good morals is not just something that grandma used to say that doesn't have any meaning. That's true. It's undeniable. An inspired statement. It is a fact of life. There is a friend. There are friends who may be a man's destruction, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Even closer than a brother. Jesus had friends that stuck closer than brothers. And we may too. Our friends, like Jonathan. Do you have a Jonathan? Think about it. Do you have one? Is there a Jonathan? Not literally a man named Jonathan. Yeah, I got a friend named Jonathan. Good guy. You have a Jonathan like David had. Somebody in your life that is that loves you as they love their own soul. Those people are hard to find. And more and more, it seems, as the world, as society, at least in our culture, becomes more and more self-reflective and self-absorbed. Really caring about somebody as much as you care about yourself. Do you have that? Do you have somebody that does that? Like David and Jonathan. I'm convinced that Jesus and John were this way. Not John the Baptizer, but John the Apostle. We don't read much about their interaction with each other, but there are little tidbits in the Gospels that seem to suggest that they may have had a closer bond than any of the others. After all, John never called himself by name in his own Gospel, but he did refer to a disciple that he called the disciple whom Jesus loved. And by deduction, you can find out that that's him himself. When he says the one whom Jesus loved, that he's talking about himself. You ever thought about the fact that Jesus committed his mother's care, his mother, to John's care while the rest of his brothers were still alive? That has blown my mind. I've never been able to get over that. How intriguing, fascinating that is. His brothers are still alive, and as he's dying, he commits his mother to John the Apostle's care. That says something about their relationship to me. The fact that John was seated at his right hand around the table says something. And remember, Peter was—he had to, you know, get his attention, ask him something, you know, because he was the one at his right hand. The fact that later on Peter was jealous of John. Right before Jesus ascended in John 21, and he says, they're talking, Peter and Jesus, and he points to this disciple that Jesus loved. He said, what about him? You know, Jesus said, quit worrying about him. John and Jesus, I think, had a special relationship like David and Jonathan. Paul and Barnabas had that. We just talked about them. Look at Paul and Timothy. Where would Timothy be without Paul, and vice versa? These were people who had somebody in their lives that was always there, period. Didn't matter. Inconvenient. Don't care. I don't worry about inconveniences for my own good, so I'm not going to worry about them for your good. Jonathan and David. Paul and Timothy. Jesus and John. Do you have a Jonathan? Do you have a David? Are you somebody else's Jonathan? If not, find one. Find you a David. Be the Jonathan in somebody's life. Be the David in somebody's life. Somebody, find them. Help them. Don't take it all on yourself. But God can put people in our lives that are meant to help us grow spiritually and get to heaven. Don't ever doubt that. He's not going to shine this halo of light around them and say, you know, ding, 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 neon lights, you know, arrows pointing. This is, here he is, or here she is, just in case you haven't noticed yet. But we can take it upon ourselves to develop these relationships and help these people, help our brothers and sisters, be knit to them, and love them as much as we love our own souls. Something for us all to think about. If you need to come this morning, if you need to start developing relationships, you can start today. If you need to, maybe you need to develop your relationship with Jesus. That's first and foremost. There's never a better time to start doing that or to pick up where you left off than right now. You have that opportunity anytime, but a special opportunity now, and we encourage you to do so as we stand together and sing.